Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, First Lady Lou Henry Hoover's role in preserving and recording White House history. I'll talk with historian Elizabeth Dinschel. But first, Inara Versemnieks grew up listening to her grandmother's stories about Latvia, the homeland and family she had to leave behind when she fled with her small children after World War II. After her grandmother's death, Versemnieks decided to visit Latvia to learn about this long-lost homeland and to meet what remained of her family. She's written about her story and the story of a nation in the new memoir, Among the Living and the Dead, a tale of exile and homecoming on the war roads of Europe. She teaches creative nonfiction at the University of Iowa, and she is here with me now. Inara, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start by talking a little bit about you. You were raised by your grandparents, and there are some difficult reasons for that. But as you were growing up, in many ways, you were an only child in this home with two elderly people. Tell me what your childhood was like.
I went to live with my grandparents when I was 2 years old, and in many ways, I came to them at the time when a child is forming her sense of language and her sense of the world and the stories of the world. And so here I was speaking in a foreign tongue. And my grandparents, like many refugees, were doing everything they could in some ways to recreate the home that they had left behind where they found themselves. And so they had a garden in which later I realized they planted it to resemble a Latvian farm in miniature. They put up their own food. My grandmother made all my clothes. In many ways, I was living in a world out of time, but it was a world that became more real to me than the one that I was living in.
And your grandparents worked hard to maintain not just their Latvian culture at home, but to introduce you to Latvian culture. So you actually went to a summer camp with other children of Latvian descent. Tell me about that.
That was really amazing. Anyone who is not part of the Latvian community is usually most fascinated by this little piece of information. The Latvian refugees pooled together their money and bought a patch of land, a beautiful patch of land in Olympia, Washington. But they were able to do that because the land bordered a state penitentiary, so it was nice and affordable. We never really noticed, although sometimes when we played Capture the Flag, we were told if we reached a certain chain link fence, we should probably turn back. But they built all of the houses of the countryside for us to live inside as dormitories, as dance halls, as places to do art. And so there we spoke only Latvian. If you were caught speaking English, you had to do 10 push-ups. I learned folk songs, folk dances, beautiful arts and crafts, how to weave in the old Latvian tradition. In many ways, it was almost as if they were preparing us. Should we ever be able to go back one day, we would have all the skills and knowledge to return to Latvia. But it was a Latvia that was the Latvia of stilled memories, not the Latvia that kept on going after everyone had left.
Well, it was impossible for them to know about the Latvia that kept on going, because after your grandparents left Latvia, the Iron Curtain came down. There
That's
was very little communication between them and their families back home, very little understanding of what was going on back in Latvia, right?
When communication actually became possible, they were aware that there were censors always taking a look at what was being sent back and forth, especially to a foreign country. And in some cases, you find old letters that are almost, they look like lace because words have been cut out by the censors. Also, too, you see the very stilted ways that people communicated. They tried to find code. They tried to find almost these strange kind of metaphorical, allegorical ways to try to reference what might have happened to them. In my family's case, the silence was extended because my grandmother's sister, her mother, and her brother were all sent to Siberia in 1949. And there was a long period of time where they were just absolutely completely lost to the world, to themselves.
When your grandparents, and mostly your grandmother, told stories about Latvia, she didn't share stories about the war. She didn't share stories about all the hardship she'd gone through. What kinds of things did she tell you about?
She talked to me in the broadest of outlines. My grandparents sensed that I was, I think every family has a story keeper. My grandparents sensed that I was the story keeper, and they gave me generalities. I understood that she had had to take my father, who was an infant, and my aunt, who was two at the time, take them and run from Riga as advancing troops came into the city. And I knew that she had then taken the children and tried to reach some place of refuge, of safety, that ultimately led her to a displaced persons camp in Germany. I could feel the sadness. I could feel what she was holding back. But she didn't fill in the details within that outline. I was coming to her after a certain amount of trauma myself, and I suspect that one of the things that she was really trying to do was to spare me some of those feelings of loss and anguish, and instead to gift me something beautiful. So what she did tell me about in great detail was the family farm upon which she grew up and which formed her, which gave her the ability, I think, in many ways, to endure what she endured and then to attempt to give me its beauty.
And this farm for you, I mean, it almost took on, it was almost a person, a character. Tell me, the name is Lemby?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Tell me about Lemby.
So Lemby became a place where my grandmother would literally, with her words, erect it, its borders, its boundaries. When we were walking around in her own backyard, she would almost take it like a stencil and lay it over the things that we were seeing so that I could begin to understand what it was like for her to run around and roam inside Lemby. And I came to see it also as a kind of refuge, as a place to which I could retreat and try to imagine what it would be like to live in such a beautiful borderless place. It also became a way for me to think about, I think, the whole parts of my grandmother's life rather than the fractured experience of a refugee. This was a place where she had a home, she had a history, and she was connected to her family. And by extension, inside these stories, I could be someone who had a whole home, a whole family.
Did you believe that the farm was still there as it was when you were growing up?
I did. I imagined when I first returned to Latvia that perhaps family was still living upon it. Communication had been a little bit, it had taken an uptick after the fall of the Soviet Union and Latvia's reclamation of independence. But then it kind of dropped off a little bit. And the last I had known, sort of almost in a game of telephone, family had been on the farm. So when I arrived, I assumed that I would be able to go visit Lemby and I would be able to walk around. And even if it wasn't exactly as my grandmother remembered, there would be outlines of it that I could immediately follow and fill in. And instead, I arrived in Latvia for the first time and found that Lemby was lost. It had been returned. It had been left to the land.
Your grandfather, we haven't talked much about him. Like so many men in Eastern Europe, he went through terrible experiences, and he was conscripted by the Germans to fight for the German side in World War II. But he did survive. He found your grandmother at that displaced persons camp. They were able to reunite. They had two more children after that. But tell me a little bit about him, because like every man who went through that terrible war, he carried it with him.
He becomes for me a symbol of one of the things that is absolutely so unforgivable and horrific about war, not just the terrible violence and the hundreds upon thousands, millions of people who are killed. The other thing is that war takes away our moral choices. Those who wage war take away the moral choices of everyone. And then yet we still have to make decisions attempting to do the best we can. And what happens is we're always haunted. We're never sure if we made the right one. In my grandfather's case, by being conscripted into the German army, he had to fight on the behalf of the Germans against the Russians. In his mind, he was doing the only thing possible. People who did not accept the call-up were killed, were imprisoned. He felt that that was something that he had to do. And yet he spent the rest of his life, I think, realizing that there is a kind of complicity in that act.
And he was on the wrong side of history.
He was on the wrong side of history. And yet what I think he felt, what could he do? And so I saw as a child someone who was hollowed out, almost in very literally in some ways. He carried real wounds from that war. And I saw the effects of PTSD. I saw the way in which many times he would fall inside of himself into the memories, rock, be completely sort of locked away. And that then obviously reverberates out through a household. When he first returned from the war, my father has very sort of my father is frightened in his memories of his father, being unable to explain why this man is so haunted, why he's so distant. In some cases, why does he rage out of nowhere? My father was also 2 years old at the point in time when my grandfather was finally reunited with him. My grandfather didn't even see him born. And that was something else that my father carried, was sort of this legacy of a father who did not bond with him, who didn't have the opportunity because of war. So even though sometimes there are literal separations in war, there are also deep psychological separations that occur, that even when people find each other again, they remain lost.
He also carried physical wounds. He lost his eye. He was shot in the head in that final battle. As a child, how did you see that?
I saw it more as a kind of fascination. I loved to watch when my grandfather would take out and clean his glass eye. It was less to me a symbol of the entire war as a child. But as I grew up, I began to see that in many ways, that hole was the way we enter all the horrors of what happened to everyone on the ground when you are crushed between two opposing forces.
When the Iron Curtain fell, when the Soviet Union broke up, when Latvia reclaimed its independence, how old were your grandparents?
My grandparents at that point were in their 70s. And it was interesting to watch their reaction. Certainly, they were absolutely deeply moved. A day that they had been waiting for forever, it felt like, finally had arrived. And yet, they were much less eager to rush to Latvia than other Latvians in the refugee community. And I think some of that had to do with whether or not it was articulated between them or even to themselves that they knew they would encounter memories, the memories that they had, they would not encounter them anymore, that those memories might not exist.
They kept this place alive, but it may not be there.
Precisely, precisely.
Do you feel like there was survivor's guilt to the fact that they got out?
That is a huge part also, I think, of some of the reluctance they felt. Also, some of what they experienced when they went. When they finally did go to Latvia, they did encounter people, and other Latvians have experienced this as well, who say, we stayed. We stayed through the worst of it. We were exiled to Siberia. You left. You had it easy. It was easy in the DP camps. You came out the best. And yet I saw the ways in which my grandparents were deeply haunted by the fact that they had had to leave everyone behind.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Inara Versemnix. She is the author of the new memoir, Among the Living and the Dead, A Tale of Exile and Homecoming on the War Roads of Europe. She'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on August 30th at 7 p.m. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Inara Versemnix. She's the author of the new memoir, The Living and the Dead, A Tale of Exile and Homecoming on the War Roads of Europe. She teaches creative nonfiction at the University of Iowa. And we've been talking about her family story. She grew up listening to her grandparents tell her about Latvia, this long-lost homeland, the homeland they fled after World War II and then were disconnected from because of the Iron Curtain. And Inara, we were talking about your grandparents, their trip back to Latvia. They went once. You didn't go with them. You had a life to lead here. After your grandmother's death, you decided to go to Latvia. What made you want to go there then?
I had reached a point in my own personal life where I was feeling stuck. I had been working as a newspaper journalist for 13 years, and I kept having a sense that I was bumping up against the boundaries of what I could do in that job. You know, the whole kind of crisis of what should I be doing? What should I do next? And ultimately, I decided to blow up my life and to leave that job and to go back to school to get my MFA. And that meant leaving a place where my husband and I had been for 13 years and selling our home. Everything just felt sort of up in the air. And at that point, I realized I need to call back. I need to call back to my history. I need to call back to my grandmother, even though she wasn't physically present in my life anymore and I missed her deeply. I thought maybe if I just returned to her history and to her family, very literally, that there might be something there that I could find that would help me put one foot in front of the other and move forward.
So after all these years, your grandmother's sister was still living and still living in the same town, or they were outside of the town when your grandmother was growing up, but still living in about the same place in Latvia. She was 14 years younger than your grandmother. What did you feel when you saw her for the first time?
I was absolutely overwhelmed. She looked exactly like my grandmother. Exactly. It was truly seeing my grandmother again, having her return to me. And what was interesting later, though, while we were having this big family dinner, I kept catching my grandmother's sister looking at me from across the table. And I realized the same way that she embodied my grandmother, there was something about me that was returning my grandmother to her.
Could you read a little bit for us that introduces us to this woman? Ausma, is that how you say her name?
Yeah.
And what she experienced, because in so many ways, these two sisters are mirrors of each other, one that remained and one that left. So tell us about her experience.
So Ausma was eventually sent to Siberia along with her family. Ausma decided to stay in Latvia in part because she wanted to help hang on to the family farm. It was such a big deal to be able to finally own land and to have this place that was theirs. And so as a result, though, of having a farm and having a certain amount of land, when collectivization began under the Soviet state, what they found was the easiest way to turn all of the property into collective property was simply to send the farmers away to Siberia.
So because they had, quote unquote, too much land, these were wealthy peasants, they were exiled.
Yes. And originally what happened was Ausma's mother and brother were picked up. Ausma was not home at the time. And as a result, in many ways, she could have hid. She could have gone on with her life. But she realized that they would never survive in Siberia without her.
She was the strong one, the whole one.
And so she went and volunteered herself to go to Siberia, went to where they were being kept in rail cars right before the journey and said, please take me. So the section I'm going to read from is just introducing Ausma's discovery of the fact that her family has been taken. It was March, the month when vipers sometimes rained from the sky, dropped onto unsuspecting heads by storks, clumsy-beaked, languorous-winged, scaly legs dragging through low clouds. If it were possible for us to rise up high enough to join them on their lazed glide across the land, to look down upon it from their point of view, this is what we might have seen on that day, at the beginning of the spring that would mark the end of her former life. Below us, the fields, stubbled and brooding, like a man slowly lifting his head from the table to see so many empty bottles. And now, the roof of the schoolhouse that had been raised from red stone, and where inside some children were still forgetting at the top of their school compositions to record the date as 1949, not 1948. There, perhaps a dog, sitting at the edge of a driveway, one hind leg hoisted toward the sky to make room for its rooting snout. Guard to what once would have been called a house, but was now nothing more than the hollowed-out testimony of a mistimed machine gun strafing. On that day, 5 years before, a Russian plane had swooped low, aiming for the German troops, retreating to the nearby road, but all that fell in the plane's wake was a horse, a woman, and finally the old farmhouse, where the woman had planned to give birth to the child who died with her. But now, this day, upon the same road, a girl, boots stamping mud in one version of her memories, bicycle wheels churning beneath her in another. Either way, sent off that morning by her mother, pinch-browed, dim-eyed, drained by the effort of trying to still the worry humming inside her like a wasp trapped between window panes. Why don't you go to town, child? Bring this fabric to the seamstress and let her measure you for a dress. She took what her mother pressed on her, said nothing. She knew what her mother really meant, that maybe in town she might hear some news about her brother. He'd driven off from their farm a day before to see about a gelding. It was long past the time he should have been back. And so Asma went, out the door of the farmhouse, past the sign into which its name was carved, Lembi, and headed in the direction of the sun. On a good day, the walk to town took 2 hours, a chance to catalog the things that had returned with winter's ouster, the first new thrusts of grass, as pale and awkward as colt's legs, the skitter of birds' claws on green wood, and then maybe the high-peeling balls of a kinglet or the dizzy gulping chants of a warbler. A truck passed, trailing a spray of mud, but otherwise it seemed as if she had the road to herself. What she could not see, her family's farmhouse, some distance behind her already, and the truck rolling to a stop in front.
That's Inara Versemnik. She's reading from her memoir, The Living and the Dead, A Tale of Exile and Homecoming on the War Roads of Europe, about her family's experience in Latvia and leaving Latvia. When you went back to Latvia, and you went there to get to know your family, to get to know the country, but to collect these family stories, it was hard for them to share these stories with you. How many times did you go back? How much time did you spend there?
I ended up spending 5 consecutive summers living in Latvia. And I would also go during winter break. So there are like 2 or 3 winters scattered in there, and sometimes some return trips just for a week or two because I needed to collect more information. But those summers are really kind of the core of the book, having the chance for 3 months at a time to live in the rhythms of the countryside and to come as close as I could possibly come to experiencing what my grandmother's life might have been like with her family. One of the things about the Latvian countryside, I don't want to oversimplify things, but it really does remain a place out of time. Once you leave the capital of the city, the countryside is almost as if you're returning back to the 18th century, maybe sometimes the 19th century. But that was really an incredible experience for me, having the opportunity to get up each day and work in the fields and also at the same time try to collect these stories. One of the things that I really tried to do was to talk with Ausma in the mornings. We sort of came to it by accident. It would usually be sort of after breakfast over tea. And I would talk to her and talk to her for as long as she could. And then she would usually say to me, okay, time to go to work. And then we would go outside and we would just work side by side. And often we wouldn't talk about anything. So even on these trips, as much research as I was doing, it might only be for a little bit each day. The real research was living in tandem with one another.
And creating those bonds. It was several summers into this project, into your life together, that Ausma asked you about your grandmother's story. It took her a long time to ask about the displaced persons camp that your grandmother and your grandfather lived at, where so Ausma and her brother and her mother, they were sent to Siberia. And they were there for 8 years?
Correct.
So a long time. They lost a great deal of their life. She lost her youth. And I'm sure at that time she was also thinking about her sister, who she couldn't communicate with, and wondering what had happened to her. When she asks you about your grandmother's story, I found myself wondering, does she want it to be worse? Does she want it to be better? What does she want? Because you could feel the anger, the envy, and the worry in that question. What did you tell her about your grandmother's life after she left?
Well, simultaneously, as I was trying to put together what had happened to Ausma, I was also trying to put together what had happened to my grandmother based on the fragmented clues that she left behind. And so even as long as it took Ausma to ask me what had happened to her, it also took me quite a while to really be able to fill in many of the gaps that had existed in my grandmother's story. And one of the things that I had found out by getting documents from the Red Cross was that my grandmother had spent 9 months from Latvia to try to reach one of the displaced persons camps.
So 9 months, 9 months of traveling with 2 small children and a friend, one woman friend.
And that, as many researchers will tell you, so often you have to do so much work sometimes to find the tiniest fact. And for me, the minute I found that fact, I felt the intensity of my grandmother's story in such a different way, what she had endured. And when you trace the path that she had taken, she was clearly heading right into the horrors of World War II, the last waning days of the war, which were especially, especially bloody. She would have seen the death marches as people were led from camps and the attempt to hide them from the Allied troops arriving. She did see Dresden firebombed. It was a place where she nearly stopped to rest with the children and her friend. Suddenly, as I began to piece all those things together, I, too, realized how much she had tried to keep from everyone else in terms of what she had endured and how much she kept inside. So when Asma was finally ready to ask me, I was finally ready to tell her. And you describe perfectly the intensity of her question, all the emotions bound up in it. And what I found when we began to talk was a sister who had felt in so many ways left behind, lost, betrayed in a sense. She had such a deep need to just be taken care of. What she realized was her sister also had such a deep need to be taken care of, but each had to bear what they had to do alone. And that even reaching that place of a kind of understanding, still having it rest on that idea that these two sisters endured so much alone and were not able to comfort one another. Yeah, I still.
And how many years did your grandparents spend in that displaced persons camp?
They ended up spending almost 7 years in the displaced persons camp. So you said that they're like mirrors in many ways, even their experiences of being sort of stuck and completely isolated and trapped somewhere were almost identical as well.
I'm talking to Inara Versemnix. The book is The Living and the Dead. And Stefan is on the line in Ames. Hi, Stefan.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Charity, and Sveik Zanara.
Ah, Sveik.
I'm listening to your story, and it's just remarkably similar to my family's. I'm of Latvian descent as well. My father and his parents and grandparents were in a displaced people's camp after the Nazis and then the Soviets took Latvia, and they were in Germany for 6 years in that camp. They eventually landed in Milwaukee, where there was a sizable Latvian community, and there was a Lutheran church there that I kind of grew up in that spoke only Latvian and now speaks English at least once a month at that church in Milwaukee. But it's just remarkable to hear, listening to your story, everything is very similar to what my dad and his parents, now passed, told me. I had a opportunity to go to Latvia with my dad 5 years ago, and we still have some family there, and it was just remarkable to see it. And he recalled he went back while the Iron Curtain was still down, and he pointed out this hotel that he stayed in, and he said, "I'm pretty sure the KGB was listening to me in that hotel." it was a lot of fun to go back there and to see all this culture that I had learned about. Unfortunately, I don't speak the language all that much. I only speak a few words. Paul Dias, and I look forward to reading your book.
Paul Dias Jums. We should get together after the show, and we can have a language group. We should find all the Latvians in Iowa.
Well, and maybe a summer camp would be a good idea as well. Stefan, thank you so much for your call. And we just have a couple of minutes left. And in your time visiting Latvia, learning about the country, learning about your family, you weren't just experiencing the past and focused on the past, but the present of Latvia, which is very difficult. They're continuing to hemorrhage population because people are going elsewhere for opportunity. This is a country really left behind in so many ways. How do you think about the future of your homeland?
When I first began to travel to Latvia, that was the point in time in which the country was seeing some of its worst population loss. Latvia had just joined the EU, which is a wonderful sign of progress in some ways. The flip side is, with those EU passports, people could travel anywhere.
Yeah.
And they could work jobs where they made much more money than they would milking cows or mucking out stalls. And so you would see the countryside dotted with empty houses. It continues. However, I have some amount of hope. There are some Latvians, like one of my cousins, who had been in Norway for several years, who has decided to come back to raise her daughters in Latvia. They've saved up enough money, much like many immigrant stories, and they are committed to trying to find a way to to be part of the country's solution rather than its dissolution. I feel connected to it in a way that I never did before. One of the things that I did while I was working on the story was get my Latvian passport. They were offering citizenship to people who were descendants of refugees. And I think I feel less concerned than I did at the beginning of the process of the book. I see many ways in which people are very aware of the tenuousness of the country, its fragility, but also the depth of its stories and the depth of its language, and want to find a way to make sure that that endures for as long as it can.
We are a nation of immigrants, of refugees. So many of us, our families, left those stories behind to start a new life. And generations on, we're completely disconnected from their stories. What do you think this has given you to have this connection with your family and your homeland?
When I went to Latvia for the first time, my husband said, "How do you feel?" I said, "I feel like my DNA is singing. I feel like I not only got my grandmother back in some ways, as much as I could. There will always be an emptiness there that represents her loss in my life. But I kind of got myself back, too."
Inara, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Inara Vrzemniaks, she's the author of the new book, Among the Living and the Dead, A Tale of Exile and Homecoming on the War Roads of Europe. She'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on August 30th at 7 p.m. She teaches creative nonfiction at the University of Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with historian Elizabeth Dinchel about the conservation work that First Lady Lou Henry Hoover did when she was in the White House. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We have all heard of the Lincoln Bedroom, the East Room, the Red Room, iconic rooms in the White House, rooms that hold so much history and have witnessed so much. But the artifacts in the White House went largely undocumented until First Lady Lou Henry Hoover, wife of President Herbert Hoover, came along. In recent years, we've finally learned about the extent and depth of her impressive work. And Elizabeth Dinchel is here. She is a historian and an educator. Education specialist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. She's just published an article, First Lady Lou Henry Hoover and the First White House Catalog in the journal White House History. Welcome back to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
And it's hard to imagine the White House, this storied place with maybe just a storehouse of furniture that people didn't know very much about. There's so much history there. But when the Hoovers arrived at the White House, I mean, not a lot of that was documented, right?
Well, correct. And a lot of it had been sold between presidential occupancies. They would auction things off the south lawn of the White House because furniture was seen as utility. It wasn't seen as history at that point.
So almost like dormitories during back to school season, they get emptied out and filled up with a new set of furniture.
Exactly. And it, just from a modern standpoint, the White House and governor's mansions are in this really unique role in historic preservation because they're living homes. So they're historic, but people still live in them. So when a new president comes in, they have the opportunity to rearrange everything, move furniture, say they don't want things in certain rooms. And the White House curatorial staff has to really hustle to move things around and document where it's going. And because they are historic artifacts and all the parts of the White House we go into that we're not allowed to cross the ropes, when there's parties in the White House, people are sitting on that furniture and drinking, and it makes curators and historians freak out a little bit because that's not how we treat historic artifacts. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between material culture and understanding their place in history when the Hoovers come into the White House at that time. And even later on, part of the reason this project started was we looked for a rug that was in the White House and it had been replaced. And they just put the same number on the new rug, but because it had worn out, they just threw it away.
Wow.
Still thinking about furniture as utility objects.
So Lou Henry Hoover started treating the White House a little bit differently. She started documenting the history of these different artifacts. And she, it sounds like she set out to make sure that every president who had lived in the White House was represented in this space?
Yeah, she did a lot of really interesting things. But there was a fire in the West Wing of the White House in 1929. And really before that, she was curious about the objects. But the fire really ignited her curiosity and made her realize that these things needed to be documented, because after the fire, they didn't even really know what they lost in the West Wing. So her and a secretary frantically went around trying to identify these objects and figuring out their provenance. And it turned out to be a very difficult task. But she also decided that the White House was a public place. She took all of the workers off of the first floor of the White House. She opened up the East Wing. They took Washington's china and put it behind glass. And they opened the White House every day for visitors from 10 to 2. And nobody had ever done that before. She was also bringing objects from the residence on the second floor down to the first floor and essentially curating exhibits for people to look at them. But when she started doing that and they started cataloging, they realized there was presidencies that were not represented in the White House. And so she actively went to the families and descendants and tried to acquire objects for the White House. The Adams china was a very famous example, where she coordinated with the Adams family and had china donated to the White House so they would have something there.
She also started this extensive catalog.
Yes.
Tell me about this catalog.
So she sought out initially just to kind of write down what was in the White House. And her secretary, Ruth Fessler, were working on that. And they started digging through the Library of Congress and other places that had some information about the objects, and found that this was going to be a huge undertaking. This wasn't something they could do in one visit to the Library of Congress. So she had a friend come in, Dare Stark McMillan, and commissioned her to really do this research and compile these indexes. And they started off with a card catalog. And Lou went through and numbered each object in the White House. And this comes from her background as a scientist. They would number scientific objects in collections. And for her, it was geological specimens. And her numbering of those White House objects is still in place today in the White House. And it's something that spilled over into museum studies later. Everything in our collection has a number assigned to it now. But they wrote three different volumes of this catalog. One of them looked at how the rooms were organized. So there's a blue room, a green room, the East Room. And there's a second catalog that organizes it by the president's term. So it's kind of like a timeline of the White House and how each president used it. There's a third catalog that is missing. President Hoover gifted it to Mamie Eisenhower. There was a scuffle between him and the archivist at the Hoover Institute, who said, "Mr. Hoover, this is really important. You can't just give this away. Maybe you should gift it to the White House and then everybody can have it forever." And he wrote her back this kind of scathing letter that said, "This is a gift for Mamie Eisenhower. It's not for the White House. And I've asked you to send it. Please send it." And it's gone. We can't find it. No one has it. So if you're digging through your attic and find a White House catalog, call the Hoover Library. We'd be interested in seeing it. But in the White House Journal, they printed one of the volumes of one of the catalogs. And Lou had always intended for it to be something that people could look at when they were guests at the White House, something that could be published for researchers. They built three massive index card catalogs with different colors and did cross-referencing. And it was a really intense tool that they created for researchers and for the general public. And she was really, really dedicated to that project. And in fact, one of the saddest things that happened with it was she wanted it published. And she said in one of her letters, "My biggest fear is this will end up in a dusty government archive somewhere and no one will ever see it." And for 85 years, she was right. That's exactly what happened. So we're really happy to see it printed now so people can look at it. And for people in Iowa or people that are passing by, you can come to the library and request to see the books and sit down with those books. One of them is on display in the museum at all times, too.
So this work although it did wind up in a dusty government archive, and we really didn't know very much about it for so long, but it still created a foundation that has been in use ever since it was created.
Right. And the Truman renovation in 1948 basically changed the entire White House. And Jacqueline Kennedy had come into the White House in the 60s and had the exact same inclination that Lou Hoover did. These things need to be documented. Where did they come from? And she established the Office of the Curator in the White House. And one of the first things they did was requested that catalog that was kind of living in lore from the Hoover Library. And to this day, the White House has this like 1963 facsimile copy that was sent to them that the pictures aren't very good. They only had one catalog. They didn't have two. So they didn't even know about the second one until I came to the White House a couple of years ago with it. And, it, you know, it's the crazy thing about it, though, is when you think about it, history is so fluid still. There's all of these records that are really important that are stuffed away in archives or they're hiding in people's attics. And they come down and we realize there's all this stuff we didn't know, you know, or that we'd heard about but we couldn't prove. And they're coming, we're able to come out with this stuff more and more and give access to people through digitization and open use of archives. And it's just really awesome to be a part of that and giving that history back to the United States, back to the people.
Now, one of the real treasures of this cataloging process that First Lady Hoover did was to get photographs taken of the archives, of the rooms of the White House set up in the very best, most perfect way. And this is an interesting moment in history as well. I mean, tell me about how she got these rooms photographed, because this was a product of the times.
Yeah. So Lou wanted to have the house photographed for official government records and for the catalog that she was making. And she started kind of headhunting for photographers. And the commander of the U.S. Signal Corps came to Lou and said, "We have these super skilled photographers. You can look at their work. They desperately need work. The Great Depression is settling in." And Lou feels almost guilted into hiring the U.S. Signal Corps, but agrees to do it at her own expense, and that there's this agreement that they understand that she owns the photographs. She will go through them and select the ones that she wants for the catalog, and the rest she will donate to the official government archive. Well, the photographs rear their ugly head again when Lou is out and sees them printed in the Ladies' Home Journal. And her friend Ava Long had written this article about life in the White House.
A very dishy article about, I mean, it wasn't bad, but about how many guests the Hoovers always had for every meal, how hard that was for the White House staff.
Yeah, it struck a lot of chords in a lot of ways. But what it ultimately ended up in resulting in was a cease and desist order coming from Lou Hoover's representation to Ladies' Home Journal, to Ava Long, to the U.S. Signal Corps. And she kind of writes this, and she was a very witty woman, but wrote a very snarky letter to the U.S. Army Signal Corps commander that says, "Have you happened to seen the Ladies' Home Journal? Does your wife get it, perhaps? Because I happened to look at it and found that my photographs were in there. Do you care to explain yourself?" And he had said that he had given souvenir copies to Ava Long. And once this happened, the next prints of Ladies' Home Journal stopped. But the photographs were already copyrighted to Ladies' Home Journal. And the catalog was already in publication, and they stopped publication.
So that action did away with the publication of this catalog.
Yes.
That's why this was lost to history.
Yes. And so now we're outside of that copyright time for those photographs for that magazine that's been out of business for a long time. And so now we can come back with those. And we do have legal provenance showing that Lou, in fact, did own them. And but it really, it destroyed the whole publication. And there were several attempts after that, and even after Lou's death in 44, to print the book. And the photograph thing came up again and again. And by time the journal had run, Lou was already out of the White House. So they couldn't just go back and ask to re-photograph.
Right. Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And ridiculous.
Right.
So now that you have at least two volumes of this catalog and have been able to really go through them and understand them and share them with White House archivists today, What do we gain from looking at this document?
Well, there's a lot of really interesting things in there, but I think a few things it gives to the field of history and archives and historic preservation, some of it being the numbering and the cataloging system, but the other parts of it showing that things had left and that there's no time that's too early to start collecting history and that we should really value that because at some point it's lost. When it's auctioned off the lawn of the White House, we can't get it back unless we know who bought it and, you know, then we have to buy it back and all that stuff. But really looking at it as well, Lou was one of the first people to go in and do historic renovations of the White House to try to restore rooms. And one of the really important rooms that she worked on was the Monroe Drawing Room. She went in and restored it, but upon doing that, had realized she really wanted a copy of the Monroe desk and the lauras that the Monroe Doctrine was signed on the desk. So she traveled to Fredericksburg, Virginia, to the Monroe Historic Site and met with the family there. And they agreed to have the Monroe desk, which is not just a desk. It's a suite of furniture. It has about 7 to 9 objects in it, sent to Washington, D.C., where she hired this really well-known furniture maker, M.W. Dove, to create exact replicas of it. And she commissioned 2, and they made an agreement that she was going to pay for it. And if congressional appropriations came through, she would leave both sets at the White House. If not, she would leave one set at the White House and take another one, but would never let anyone make a copy of it, and she would never sell it. And they agreed. So she paid $1,010 to have exact replicas made. The actual Monroe desk is still in Fredericksburg, Virginia. The one copy is at the White House. The other copy Lou used for her entire life. And one of the really famous parts of the Monroe desk is that there was a hidden drawer in it. And after Lou passed away and someone figured out how to open the drawer, there was a stack of thank you letters to Lou and uncashed checks that people that tried to repay her for donations she had made. And the desk remained in the family forever. We received it as a donation in 2014 from the Hoover family, and it lives at the Hoover Museum. It was on display during our First Lady's exhibit. And so it's come to Iowa now, and it lives here, which is awesome. People have written PhD dissertations about the Monroe furniture and the copies that were made. And Lou, at her own expense, did that and honored the agreement she made with the Monroe family. It's really great. The other thing they tried to work on was the Lincoln office. That was really where President Hoover wanted to work.
Now known as the Lincoln bedroom.
Actually still just a different room in the residence.
Right.
But no one had ever attempted to, again, try to restore a room in the White House. And they'd already found that there was a black market for Lincoln objects, even in the, you know, early 30s, and they couldn't buy stuff back. It was too expensive, and they were going to leave it. So they hired a company in New York City called the Arden House that helped them redesign the room, and they picked fabrics. And we actually have those fabric swatches in the Hoover collections, which is really cool. And they redid the room in the spirit of Lincoln.
Okay.
And that's where Hoover worked while he was president.
Well, one of the things that I always take away from our conversations is there's so much to Lou Henry Hoover that we just didn't know.
Yes.
What an extraordinary woman.
She really was. Every day. Every day.
And she undertook this entirely of her own volition. Did the work largely herself.
Paid for it
herself. And left this gift to history.
Yes. Absolutely. Every day she surprises us. It's really remarkable how much she accomplished between Girl Scouts and historic preservation and her efforts as a volunteer and the way she spent her money and supported people. It was really remarkable.
Well, Elizabeth Dinchel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Historian Elizabeth Dinchel of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. She recently had an article published in the journal White House History. The article is First Lady Lou Henry Hoover and the First White House Catalog. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.